Welcome back. This is our third series in third of a series of going through all of Jung's major works. And by major works, I mean principally those written after 1944, when he had a heart attack and really sat down and started putting to paper the ideas he had spent a lifetime discovering and substantiating. For next time, yeah, if you don't mind buying the book, Ion, it's not big. It's of all the ones we have done and will be doing, it's one of the readable ones, so you can start building up a library. And then I think I'm going to ask you to also to buy, if you want to continue coming the time after, we'll be doing Answer to Job. You can also buy Answer to Job. It's about $10, too. That'll be about the only two books you need to buy.
Both
Jung? No, both Jung.
Both Jung? Oh, okay.
Now, we'll be looking at the primary source.
Oh, okay.
So Ion by Jung and Answer to Job by Jung. They're both in paperback. Thanks to Jane for arranging the room. Thanks to Kathy and Jane for all their work setting up and for all the other things they do. We'll take a break this morning about halfway through, and we will take an hour for lunch, and then we'll take a very short break in the afternoon. We go from 9:30 to 12 with a break, and then we go from 1 to 2:30 with a stretch. Then we'll be done. A lot of material. Today we're doing the second half of Mysterium Conjunctionis. What we've done so far is Symbols of Transformation, and we've done Volume 1 of Mysterium. Mysterium is by far Jung's largest work. He spent 10 years writing it. The rest of the other works he would spend a month maybe writing. So that's why I decided to devote 2 weeks to it. And what I would like to try to give you a feel, if you want to stick with this series, is how Jung's work holds together as one complete piece, and how each volume adds a certain segment to the overall grasp of what he felt we needed to know to do this analytic journey. And I thought I would just start off very briefly looking at one or two sentences from Volume 5, Symbols of Transformation. Now, that was the book that we did in the first workshop, and it was written when he was still half a Freudian, but it really does give a nice starting place for understanding how the ideas developed. And so I just typed up what I think is the most important sentence in that book in the beginning of your study guide. I will read it for you and then try to see how the other ideas have evolved from that. The unconscious takes over the forward striving function, the process of transformation in time, and breaks the deadlock. The contents then pouring into consciousness are archetypal representations of what the conscious mind should have experienced if a deadlock was to be avoided. That's the main sentence, I think, of the book. What's so important about it is it is coming out of the Freudian framework that maybe the door's locked or something.
It's hard to
get again. Oh. The basic model that Jung is working with in Symbols of Transformation is the hero myth. The hero slays the dragon. It's very much a power image. Ego over unconscious. That's the basic Freudian model. What Jung observed is when the ego can fight the destructive aspects of the unconscious, the unconscious becomes creative and leads us forward. So where Freud took the unconscious as a repository of the past, what Jung is discovering and articulating, well, it does more than just show us the past. It actually shows us the way into the future. That's volume 5. But it's not so simple. Once we face the inner world, it's not simply a matter, he soon realized, always as simple as the unconscious starts guiding us forward. Certain steps have to be taken by the ego, by the conscious personality, to make that forward driving function of the unconscious accessible to us. And that is what the rest of his authorship is about. The one model he goes to is, of course, alchemy, which is what Mysterium Jungianus is about. There, the basic model is that forward striving function manifests if we squarely face our conflict. If we face our inner polarity of opposites. So that's alchemy in a nutshell. Today what we'll be looking at is what are the nature of those opposites, and then how do they contribute to this forward striving function. Just to kind of sum up for you the others, when we get to Ion, he will be talking about, and I'm putting it very simply, that in order to get that forward striving function of the unconscious working, we have to be dealing with withdrawing projections. So opposites is Mysterium, withdrawing projections is Ion. Another aspect of it that we'll be working with is at some points, and he realized, no matter what the ego does, the unconscious does not respond creatively, but insists on responding destructively. And that's what he tried to understand through the Book of Job. So there the ego has to stand against the unconscious in a particular way, so that it will eventually turn positive. So all these other books, I've just given you the three of the main ones, will be looking at what the ego has to do to make that forward striving function, which he first discovered in 1913, available to us. That's the first two paragraphs. So what the ego has to do is create the conditions for the unconscious is becoming creative and showing us its forward, future creating capacity. I mean, it literally knows where we are to go and how we're to get there. So now back to Mysterium. Mysterium, meaning the mysterious union, Mysterium Jungianus, the union would be the union of the opposites I just mentioned. And Mysterium, because ultimately it is a mystery, how, if the ego takes its stand, the unconscious does respond creatively. Last time we talked about the first three chapters, and the book is largely simply a look at what typical opposites appear in people's dreams when they begin to work with their inner world. And of course, there can be, the way it shows up in dreams can be, you know, almost endless. But Jung was trying to see, are there typical themes in those pairing of opposites? And what we talked about last time was the theme of the sun and the moon. With the sun being represented by the lion and sulfur, and the moon represented by dog and salt. That's just it in a nutshell. Today, we're going to look at the last two pairs of opposites that Jung talks about, the king and the queen, and Adam and Eve. So all our time today will be spent on those two pairs of opposites, and Jung ends the book by discussing how he understands this union works. So king and queen, Adam and Eve, and as he puts it, the three stages of the communio, the three stages of union. He thinks there is a sequence of processes that occur as the ego faces its conflict and the unconscious begins to provide the solution of the conflict. That occurs in specific stages, and those stages are three. So that will finish up today. Questions? This is, we're small enough, we can just, and I don't think we have any raving extroverts, so we can relax and let the discussion flow. If you have questions, why just holler?
So within, this is a stage that we go through over and over again in lifetime. It's not a one-time
thing. No, it's not a one-time thing. Although,
you think like the first big one, there's like a big one and then there are littler ones that you go through?
I think so, yeah. Usually, when you come into this sort of work, this, to see somebody like myself, you have a specific issue. Not always, but very often. You know, work, relationship, blah, blah, whatever it is. And, of course, there are external things to get clear. That's obvious. But if for people who want to go deeper, what we find often is that the outer problem, which is a problem in itself and has to be solved, is often a reflection of an inner state. So that magically, quote unquote, the outer world has fallen into line in just the way you are complicated inside. And what that complication consists of is a conflict. There are two incompatible tendencies at war. And generally, then the first big event in self-discovery after clearing up problems is wrestling with that first appearance of these conflicts that you were not aware of that had been living themselves out in outer world, in the outer world.
The inner conflict.
Inner conflict. And then some people will feel that what has come out of the wrestling with the conflict, this union that we've talked about, adds so much to life that they stick with it. And they continue observing their inner polarities because the benefit of the resolution makes life so interesting that that process becomes fascinating in itself. But yeah, I think generally the first one is a big whammy. And then you kind of get used to getting beat up from the inside and you find that the internal process itself is interesting and affords life possibilities that otherwise would not be available.
You'd never see it.
Do
you find that people who don't then just stay stuck in that external conflict over and over and over again or recreate that over and over?
Well,
if they don't get it.
Oh, if they don't get the first time around, oh, definitely. Definitely, yeah. So, you know, what you come away with after a certain amount of hard inner work is that what at first seemed like a pain in the behind was actually an invitation into a deeper world. And though if you don't complete it, you generally stay stuck. I brought a dream along of a stuck person. Right. It's always the question, can that first inner confrontation take place? Okay, let's go to the king and the queen. I've simply shown you, what I've tried to do is go through the last half of the book and just pick out the absolute most important paragraphs so that you will become acquainted with the book's main argument. Then if you wish to read the book, I would recommend getting the Mysterium lectures. What I am trying to do is prepare you to read this. And if you can read this, then you can read this.
That's called the Mysterium Lectures?
Study Guide by Edinger's Mysterium Lectures. Don't try to read this, because you'll get so frustrated you'll jump off a bridge. But this I hope will become accessible to you after having done this. My goal is to prepare you to tackle it this way, so that you at least have in your mind what the main arguments are. And then when you're reading this, you don't mind so much if you lose the trees for the forest. Okay, the king is a very important image. Of course, it doesn't always show up in Americans' dreams as kings, because we are a nation that was founded in rebellion to kingship. But you will see it, the king is the archetype. And you will see it in our dreams, like the president, or the principal, or the doctor, or the preacher, some authority figure. But the king is the general all-around image, so we'll be talking about it in terms of king and queen. So I'll read you what Jung wrote. The further we go back in history, the more evident does the king's divinity become. The king was the magical source of welfare and prosperity for the entire organic community of man, animal, and plant. From him flowed the life and prosperity of his subjects, the increase of the herds, the fertility of the land. This signification of kingship was not invented a priori. It is a psychic a priori. Sorry, it was not invented a posteriori. It is a psychic a priori which reaches back into prehistory and comes very close to being a natural revelation of the psychic structure. Now let's try to put that in our own words. But before we did, I just brought along some some alchemical pictures to show you how frequently this image of king and queen shows up. That's medieval king and queen, and king and queen. Very frequent image in alchemy. Let's talk a little bit about what this paragraph says. Jung is going back to, really, Egypt, I think, is the first place we see this, where society was arranged around a king. And all the rituals of that society were based on maintaining a relationship to that king and on keeping that king potent. If the crops failed, if there was social disorder in that early society's mind, it was because the king wasn't doing his job, and they'd kill him. So being a king was a very risky business. And they install a new king with a new set of rituals to make sure he had power. Where did he get his power? From God. So earliest societies were based around God, who had a relationship not to the individual society, but to the king. And the individual society maintained its relationship to God through its relationship to the king. So the king's power coming from God is what made for social harmony, what made for good crops, what made for fertility in the animals. So there's this hierarchy, a God ruling king and society. Now Jung feels that is an externalization of the fundamental structure of the personality. Taken as a metaphor, God would represent the self, the creative center of the personality, which is not ego. That self has its influence on us, the king, or the ego being the in the metaphor analogous to the society, through images that represent its state of affairs. So if you take it now as a metaphor, the king would represent the self. King would be in touch with God, which would mean that our inner king would be in touch with the self. And our inner king would represent the value system that reflects the state of the self at a given moment. So where in the society, the king would be an authoritarian power, as a metaphor in us, the king would represent a ruling set of principles and values. It's kind of complicated. Yes, it would be conscience, but Jung distinguishes between conscience and superego. Superego would be the values of the society that are interjected. The king image would be the values of the individual, that the individual needs to be able to complete their purpose in life. In a stable society, they are very often the same. In an unstable society like our time, the ruling principles have so little to do with what is required for life to flourish that individuals in conflict with that society will be in relationship to their own inner authority and be possessing a value system in conflict with the superego. So Jung makes this distinction between conscience and superego. And he's using conscience in the way, you know, let's say a dissident following his conscience may be breaking the rules of the society.
Like the monks in Burma.
Like the monks in Burma. And I'm fascinated by Vaclav Havel, who followed his conscience and ended up in prison. Monks getting shot. I mean, that's conscience. And in our language, what they are doing, they are adhering to their values. And those values are, in the best healthy individual, a reflection of the state of that self at the moment. Two things I want to say there. One, the nature of the self changes over time. What is important, the self of a child is different than the self of a young mother, is different than the self of the empty nester, is different than the self of somebody facing death. So that king has to change throughout life. The king, as the portrait of the functioning value system, must change because the essence of the personality changes. Or, putting it very simply, your values have to change throughout life. What? The values it took to buy your house are not the same values it will take to sell that house and move into retirement, and so on. So that introduces the notion that the king has to go through periodic processes of death and rebirth.
Isn't your king, as a child, informed by your family of origin and their, you know, their king?
I think it depends on the child.
You have to kind of separate and learn to distinguish and discern.
I brought along a dream that's going to contradict that.
If it's dysfunctional, you know, one would have to, you know, extricate themselves from maybe projections of the parent king into the child.
Not only dysfunctional. I think children sometimes do have crises of conscience. And I brought along a dream of a crisis of conscience of a three-year-old. On the whole, I think you're right. But I would leave room for the individual exception. The other thing I wanted to mention, which you have touched on, is that there is a parallelism between the struggle of the individual, certainly the creative individual, and the growth of the society, or the family, or society taken small s or big s. That, as I said, and I think in a stable society, where the values that are generally accepted are those that enhance life, unlike our time, and the values of the self are, of the individual, are parallel. In other words, that there is a relationship between the collective self and the personal self. There is a self of a group as much as there is a self of an individual. But in a time of change, where the values of the society need to change because the self of the society is changing, the collective self is changing, the inner individual will be wrestling with the shift in values in themselves that the society needs to follow. So that this death and rebirth of the king can both be a personal death and rebirth, or it can be that individual going through a death and rebirth of values which the society needs to pay attention to. Does that make sense? As far as Jung's concerned, it always happens within the individual first.
One can be having within your own king, let's say, you know, politically, let's say, that if you're at odds with, say, the decisions that your political countries make.
Yeah.
But your own king can be have a certain perspective in the collective, the society change, as evidenced by the president's decisions, you know, like Iraq, where you could be at odds with this.
You will be at odds.
Yeah, and you're wrestling within your own self to get to kind of discern what's yours to change individually and what is being kind of bleeding into you from the society, you know?
It's both at the same time.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So that at first, generally, but leaving room for exceptions, at first, generally, it's your own inner thing. And eventually, if you stick with it long enough, you will come into conflict with your society in this day and age, because the society is so disturbed, that your own king will go through a process of death and rebirth. In other words, your own value system will transform, and you will realize you are in possession of values that are antithetical to the values of the society. And then you'll either go belly up, or you'll become creative and start articulating that tension. And so I'm anticipating the end. We're starting with an internal thing, but we're going to end up with a relationship between the internal and external, because you can't do it without a relationship to the external. Yeah.
Carl Menninger talks, from the Menninger Clinic, talks about this, that over the lifetime of his career, he said the issues that he first saw in his psychotic patients became the issues that he saw in his general clinical patients about 15 or 20 years later, and then became the issues in the culture after that. And when I read that, I thought part of the reason people might go psychotic is when you start having these new values come up, and you, first of all, there's nothing in the society that in any way validates that. So, you know, it probably comes in through the people who have the least boundaries to keep it out, so they're vulnerable anyway. But then when it starts happening in a culture that tells you that it's terrible and awful, you have no support, and that may drive you crazy. It's a really interesting thing. And the book I read that in was written in the 50s, so he was talking about the arc from earlier in the century over, but
up
probably...
it's still going on, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, we're just getting started. But you see how it mushrooms out into a social perspective. And, you know, some of you have heard me say this before, that I think this is where Jungian psychology needs to go, to work on this. What Jung did was work on the internal plane, but he very well knew that as soon as you get in the internal plane, you come into collision with society, and what looks like at first I can't get along with society eventually becomes I have something to give to society to bring it along. Okay, what I've just said, hopefully, is what you will hear in paragraph 356. The king, like every archetype, is not just a static image. He signifies a dynamic process whereby the carrier, human carrier of mystery, that is, its relationship to the self, is included in the mysterious drama of God's incarnation. That is, the self wants its values communicated to both you and to your society. The transformation of the king, that's a typo, from an imperfect state into a perfect, whole, and incorruptible essence is portrayed in a similar manner in alchemy. So what alchemy is about the transformation of the king. In these recipes that we'll be looking at, their medieval mind didn't say we're going to turn this piece of material into gold. The medieval mind said we're going to take the old, inadequate king in the lead, and we're going to turn that king into a new healthy king, and when that new healthy king is born, the lead will turn into gold. So by looking at the symbolism of the king and his transformation, we learn in alchemy, we learn a whole lot about what the psyche goes through as it tries to shift its values. And for Jung, this is so important because Jung does not feel the past causes present problems. His feeling is inadequate value systems in the present cause the problems. Those inadequate value systems need to be transformed. In order to transform them, sometimes you have to go back to the past to get what you lost. But the past isn't causing them, the present is causing them. So the king really is an enormously important image for Jung's fundamental standpoint that what is at issue in psychological growth is a recognition and transformation of values. What's important to you? So the king I first mentioned is as an image is really a process. A process whereby value systems are transformed so that they represent the inner state of the self, which is itself a dynamic process at any given stage of an individual's life and in a parallel way to the given stage of society. When the king image shows up, yes.
Yeah, this whole thing about going to the past, you know, there's a real rejection of that often, especially in the most right work. You know, and yet it's not so much you're going back to, you're going back to the dress of value systems, what you're saying. Value systems of the person.
When this imagery shows up in the dream. Now, Jung is not, I should say, these folks have heard this before, but let me repeat it. Jung is not disregarding the value of a reductive analysis, of going back to the past. But in the final analysis, he feels this is a portrait of the deeper transformation of people who want to go that way. And so if their dreams go back to the past, we go back to the past. When the images of the king, but remember, we Americans don't generally dream of kings, we dream of presidents, or I no longer dream of a preacher. When those images come up, it is very often then a question of, okay, your values are under assault from your inner self because they don't match what you need to move forward in life. Then the investigation of the past is not cause-effect, but where do we find in you what you need to complete this transformation of the king? Go.
Father images,
yes. See, what we're talking about is the difference between an archetypal and a personalistic interpretation. Sometimes dad in dreams is dad, and you need to go back to the past to see how you are unconscious of a father-daughter, father-son relationship and how that's repeating strictly out of a causal framework, and that's completely within Jung's purview. But there are times when that father, often with a twist, a little bigger than life, is not about dad but about your values. Of course, for a woman, it would be more likely the queen or the mother. But it's enormously complicated once you get into the practice of it. I brought along a dream of this 3-year-old about a king.
So, Gary, could you just give an example then of going back and getting that something, what that looks like and how, in an individual, how can you carry that forward? Can you think of that dream? touch on that? Exactly what are you getting when you go back? You have a dream of something that happened in the past, or you're working on that issue. Now you go back to it. Is there a seed in there? Is there something about you as a person?
Maybe I should give an example.
Okay.
Some of you guys heard this, but I think it's so beautiful it's worth repeating. I spoke at a Unitarian church last week, and I interpreted one of the congregation's dreams. But before that, they had the kids come up, sit on the, well, what do you call that? Not the altar, but space in front of the altar. Yeah, well, the front of the altar. In front of the altar. And one of the moms sort of gave the kids a 2-minute talk on what dreams were. And just to include the kids, you know, and then they went off to Sunday school. But the mom said, have any of you kids have dreams? And a girl who was 8 years old said, yes, I had a dream 5 years ago. It's the only dream I've ever had, and I've never forgotten it. And I talked to her after that. I said, you had that dream when you were 3? She said, yes. I said, you remember that? She said, yes. And she was now 8. So I asked her to tell me again, and I took notes. And so this is my reconstruction of her dream. There's a contest between a dwarf and a princess.
Hmm.
Who would the king pick as his favorite? See, there's the king.
Shrek.
Pardon?
Movie Shrek.
I didn't see it. Is it about that?
She's a princess. The king wants her, but she's really an ogre, and she switches during the night. She's an ogre, and during the day.
Oh, but wait till you see who the king picks. Who do you think the king picks?
The dwarf.
See, that's a very creative young woman. Dwarves in all myths are the creator gods. So I'll just stop there for a moment. The way I understood that is there is a conflict in her. Am I going to be the prom queen? Am I going to be a girl who fashions herself after a collective image of beauty and is the princess of high school, cheerleader, prom queen, homecoming queen? Or am I going to follow my creativity? And the dream shows her value system is supporting her eschewing the attention she would get by being a conventionally pretty girl and following her creativity. The loser, I'm picking up, the loser gets put in a monkey cage. The dwarf is picked, and the princess and my mother is put in the monkey cage with the monkey. I get a huge ball, and I roll it and smash it into the monkey cage, and my mom and the princess gets free, and this is all written about in the newspaper. This is all written up in the newspaper. So there is a personal value system that is supporting the child, following its creativity. You see, I don't think you can say this is an interjected value system because it goes against the mother. This is the pure self, unaffected by standards of the time, and actually going against the standards of the time, because the standards of the time say to a girl, be a princess. You get a bigger house and a bigger car, and everyone admires you. But herself is putting her on a different route. But what I also think is so interesting then, you know, another key image of the self is the ball. That because she, her value system is working to support her creativity, and she recognizes that in the dream, she gets the self. And the self then smashes the cage of the traditional feminine. So in the long run, she can be both a pretty girl and a creative woman, but only after she accepts the creative woman aspect. So I cite that to show you it is not an introject. The dream shows it's not an introject. Now, to your question, let's suppose she, in fact, decides to become the prom queen and doesn't follow the dwarf's way, doesn't develop her creativity. You could just tell by looking at her. She was just full of creative energy, bubbly 8-year-old. Pretty, but not in a classical way. You know, glasses, that sort of girl, just endearing, but endearing because she was so bubbly. Let's suppose she says, well, you know, I got to get eye contacts. I got to get my hair straightened. You know, I got to work out. And she follows the princess route. Later down the road, she's probably going to come into a situation, let's say she's in a job, she gets bored, and then she would begin dreaming of her childhood as that part of herself that is not included in what the self is asking her to be. But in back of this all is always the value system that is asking for something, primarily, and then the past does or doesn't contribute to the development of that value system, but it's not the past, it's the past relationship to that value system as it's functioning in the present. And I don't know about written about in the newspaper, I imagine this girl could become a very creative voice when she's older.
It'd be interesting
that. And that she will publish. Mm-hmm. She could be a budding writer. I mean, who remembers dreams from 3 years old when you're 8? And tells it precisely. You see, that's the you can see the literary gift right there. Okay, well, I brought along an alchemical text where, actually, I brought along two alchemical texts, which show the transformation of the king to give you a sense now how you'll work with these texts and what that tells us about how we can learn this process of growth through studying alchemical texts. Both of these are medieval, and on page 2, the one I typed up, the italicized is the text. I'll just read it, and then we'll look at Jung's interpretation. So what Mysterium is now in this section, King and Queen, is just text after text after text after text, where he gives a text and he interprets it. So I think if you know one text, how Jung is working with it, and you can then see how these other texts are explained in Mysterium, in the Mysterium lectures, the book isn't so complicated because you get so lost in the details thinking, now, why is he talking about this and that? Well, all it is just different examples of the king and queen transformation. So hopefully this will help you keep some of that in order if you decide to read it. The allegory tells of a certain king who made ready for battle. As he was about to mount his horse, he wished for a drink of water. A servant asked him what water he would like, and the king answered, I demand the water which is closest to my heart and which likes me above all things. When the servant brought it, the king drank so much that all his limbs were filled and all his veins inflated, and he himself became discolored. See, that's a sick value system, which is greedy. His soldiers urged him to mount his horse, but he said he could not. I am heavy and my head hurts me, and it seems to me as though all my limbs were falling apart. He demanded to be placed in a heated chamber where he could sweat the water out. And I brought a long picture of that. But when after a while they opened the chamber, he lay there as if dead. The Egyptian physicians tore the king into little pieces, ground them into powder, mixed them with their moistening medicines, and put the king back into his heated chamber as before. After some time, they fetched him out again, half dead. They washed him with sweet water, mixed him with new substances. They put him back in the chamber as before. When they took him out this time, he was really dead. But the physician said, we have killed him that he may become better and stronger in this world after his resurrection on the judgment day. And this theme of killing the king, you see there? See, the king is drowning. You see him? He's got his hands up. Oh, you can't see that? Uh-oh. Well,
there's water back there.
Like a
lake.
Yeah, I guess it is hard to see. Sorry. Should have given it a closer. Well, that's fine. Here's some more graphic ones.
Oh, okay.
this killing the king, devouring the king, chopping the king, burning the king, there's the animal attribute of the king on fire. There's a little more graphic. It's a very common image in alchemy. So that would represent the psyche's own tendency to destroy value systems that are no longer working. We killed him that he may become better and stronger in this world after his resurrection on the day of judgment. The king's relatives, however, considered them mountebanks, took their medicines away from them, and drove them out of the kingdom. The Alexandrian physicians took the body, ground it to powder a second time, washed it well until nothing of the previous medicines remained, and dried it. They took one part of Salamoniac, which is rock salt, two parts of Alexandrian nitre, which is saltpeter, mixed them with the pulverized corpse, made it into a paste with a little linseed oil, and placed it in a crucible-shaped chamber. Then they heaped fire upon it and melted it. Whereupon the king rose up from death and cried in a loud voice, "Where are my enemies? I shall kill them all if they do not submit to me." So here's Jung's commentary summarized in a paragraph. The king personifies a hypertrophy of the ego which calls for compensation. The hypertrophy of the ego would mean inflated, puffed up, big shot. So the king would represent the value systems of a big shot, Mr. Big Stuff. He is about to commit an act of violence, a sure sign. Of his morally defective state. So the value system is no longer able to guide the individual in moral action. His thirst is due to his boundless concupiscence, which is unbridled desire and egotism. Here we're talking about a value system in general. We would see it as the values of somebody who is overbearing, obnoxious, self-centered, pushy. Well, in modern language, this would be the value system of a narcissist.
Women who drive very large SUVs with nothing else in it but themselves.
So we're talking about the masculine woman?
No.
They came within the woman as well.
But you know, look at the women in those expeditions. You know, they're way up off the ground, they've got this great big power underneath them, they're consuming huge amounts of things, and they're supposedly and they're supposedly taking care of their children when in actuality they're consuming their children's future.
It would be first we would see it in the value system of a person behaving in the way that Janice mentioned. It is also now our general style. So it's both. What we would be working with in an individual case would be somebody of that egotistical nature who has got into a mess in life. Of course, they would see it all as what's out there. Not real. And what we would try to help them see is how they are out of balance with themselves and how their own inner reactions are critiquing their egocentricity. But I think it is very much also the general style of the time. Now, it is a king, which would mean it is basically a standard of masculine behavior. But we both have standards of masculine behavior and feminine behavior in us. And in that case, if it were a woman, it would be that the masculine dominant is controlling their life. And we're not here to make value judgments, but to ask, is that serving you well? And if we can see in the dreams that it's under assault, we would assume, no, it is not serving you well. You may be saying the problem is everybody else in the world, but your dreams are saying your value system is no longer functioning to help you move forward.
Look at Ken Lay and all those CEOs, you know, and the WorldCom and all those, you know, they built themselves up, they had these huge mansions and very kind of things, and even like Ken Lay, I didn't do anything wrong, it was always somebody else, but they got caught. So in other words, probably rather than it happening internally, then they got caught by the law. In other words, you were talking about synchronicity.
Yeah, very often it does happen externally first.
Yeah, the self came out and grabbed them from it externally, you know.
Yes?
And in terms of these pictures, like the puddling
yes.
of that one, could it also be like a revolution against the king who embodies value systems of the culture that aren't working? You know, in terms of a legitimate revolution.
I think that's what political revolutions are. When the self of the group can no longer tolerate the value system of the individual. Yes, sorry, of the king or of the society. Usually of the tyrant. Yeah.
Could you give me...
Let me have Kate.
The way you can ask water, I've been making water, which was closest to my heart, the most likely of all things. Is that language like indicative of the inflation, or is that just...
I brought along a water dream.
Oh, okay.
Don't ask me why exactly, but the image which very frequently appears in people's dreams who have this sort of psychology is that they're very thirsty, they're drinking, they're saturated, and they're still thirsty. I would say roughly that would mean that the flow of life no longer satisfies them because their values aren't able to direct them to the part of life that would be satisfying. So they're driven, like Janice says, for bigger this, bigger that. That's the thirst, but it doesn't satisfy them, so they keep accruing and accruing and till they burst.
Could you give an example of how this might happen, this assault by the psyche in an actual person, say in therapy? You know, what kind of things actually start happening to a real person?
Oh, I think in the way that's experienced in reality would be a depression, outbursts of emotion. Probably those two are the biggest. And I think often it doesn't show up initially inwardly. It shows up initially outwardly as a catastrophe. But when you examine the catastrophe externally, you see it's been preceded by a catastrophe internally, and that the external difficulty is a externalization of the internal pummeling.
That's something like a demon, you know, even if it hasn't manifested
in physical. Yes, absolutely. A demon. Yes, or I think some disease. Something, whatever it is, whether it's an internal state, a bodily reaction, or an external catastrophe or problem, the individual comes up against something that stops their life from moving forward. Alcoholism, the third bad marriage, obesity, yeah. Any place where your will is thwarted.
That's your ego will?
That would be the will of the ego. Because the will, the value system as it first functions is the values by which the will, or by which the individual makes the decisions by which he or she implements the will.
Pirates of the Caribbean is all about this. That series is exactly this. The pirates Barbossa, they no matter what they drink, see, they're skeletons, and they come out. Remember, he's on the ship and he drinks. He says, "I'm too long been thirsty and not been satisfied, too long eat and hungry." Because and he drinks this thing and the water, because he's a skeleton, the drink just flows through him and out again.
That's it.
And because they have. taken the Aztec gold, the wrong gold, and sold it, and they cursed, and they have to put it all back again before they can be healed again. It's exactly this thing.
Let's go on here, and then I'll give you another example. Let's see. But when he drinks, he is overwhelmed by the unconscious. The difference between the Egyptian and the Alexandrian physician seems to be that the former moistened the corpse, but the latter dried it. The technical error of the Egyptians, therefore, was that they did not separate the conscious from the unconscious sufficiently, whereas the Alexandrians avoided this mistake. In other words, that would mean that a reductive work is necessary at this point. That you would say, well, the reason you have a need for a big car is inferiority feelings which come from the past. You try to shrink them down. In the minds of the adepts, marination means the informing penetration of sapientia into the ignoble mass, whereby the corruptible form is changed into an incorruptible and immutable one. That means you simply have to begin reflecting on what is the wise way to live my life. Sapiency here would be wisdom. So looking at where you're too big and what caused it is what this recipe is indicating as the solution, so that a reductive analysis of your Mr. Big Shot has to begin, and then you have to begin reflecting on what is wisdom. How do I live my life from the point of view of what is wise for me, not what gets me the most attention? Now, this is just the very first problem. We'll look at one soon, which is deeper. But Jung says, certainly there is little trace of this in our somewhat crude parable. Also, the transformation of the king seems to betoken only the primitive renewal of his life force. For the king's first remark after his resuscitation shows that his bellicosity is undiminished. So this is a very shallow text. I brought along a shallow to start with, a deeper one so you can compare what the two look like. In later text, however, the end product is never just a strengthening or rejuvenation or renewal of the initial state, but a transformation into a higher nature. So this is simply a guy whose values have got him into trouble, or a person whose values have got him into trouble, and the process of growth really doesn't lead to much change. It leads basically to a restating of what he used to be before, but better able to cope.
What is process
Well, and this is actually an alchemical recipe.
Pardon me?
This is actually an alchemical recipe.
Yeah, that's a homeopathic process. You know, so when you get to the essence, where can you get a high potency of the remedy? You actually don't have any of the actual plant or whatever it's made from there. You can have the essence, the spirit, the energy of the medicine.
Well, but remember, this is a metaphor.
Yeah, well,
homeopathy does it really.
Yeah.
Well,
that's the nature of homeopathy.
Is it? Well, what Jung then is trying to do is take that homeopathic principle and apply it psychologically.
Right. And there's a lot of corollaries.
Mm-hmm.
Here, you said that there was, in fact,
well, a very little transformation. He starts off pugnacious, and he ends up pugnacious. It is really not a deep transformation. So that the value system to start off with would be the value system of somebody who's a feisty, too feisty. And they don't ever really change that. They just get their feet back on the ground as a feisty person.
This is what Bush is trying to do to the United States.
Let's try to keep it to the imagery. I would love to talk wider, but we just don't have time.
So there really wasn't a transformation per se.
There was a death and rebirth with no real fundamental transformation.
Just better able to cope.
Better able to cope in the old way.
Okay. So it doesn't mean really significant or profound has really occurred.
No.
But somehow they were able to get back.
Get back on their feet.
So would this be a person who went through a depression but never really reflected on?
Never really changed. Right.
So this is like maintenance on the
values?
I mean,
this is, yeah, value maintenance.
Yeah.
A value lube job.
Yeah, kind of a tune-up.
A value tune-up. The next one I brought along will show a fundamental shift, and I wanted to give you a sense how these two play off against each other. But, you know, just also to get you thinking how important the king image is, that it does represent a value system, that value system should reflect the self, and when the psyche is talking about change, the imagery that it uses is very often is death and rebirth of the king, representing the death and rebirth of a value system.
Would this also be a reflection of you go through this attempt first, and then it doesn't really. You have to do that so many times until you see the utility of not really reflecting and changing.
You're raising a very difficult question, which we sort of batted about when we were sitting here waiting to start. Can everyone change? And what strikes me often is that some people come in and they have a minor or, you know, minor to moderate complaint. They're not psychotic. And they have to go through hell to solve that thing. Other people come in and they can do a couple months' work and they're back on their feet and they're happy carrots and they go back out in the world again. The happy carrot would be more likely going through this process, where the other person will be going through the process that we're talking about next. Why the difference? I think we have to say different people are born to complete different meanings. And the person who really is going to live the life most meaningfully, maybe for their family and for the society, is going to have the hardest time. Because the change that is required for them to get back on their feet is the deepest one. So, when I see somebody happy after a little bit of work back on their feet, I just have to say that's who they are. It may not satisfy me from this, you know, from the deeper point of view, but their life's working again. It's a real puzzling part of the work. And you read in the textbooks, well, this sort of damage means, I don't think it has anything to do with that. I think it's a matter of faith. Some people can get by with this, others cannot get by with it. And that's just the way they're born. I brought along a water dream. As you can see, it's not a good prognosis. I was at a conference and was watching a movie. The movie was showing all kinds of animals in great size, like they had mutated. There were lions and some animal I knew but don't remember what it was now. They were giant-sized. Even the lions were all so much bigger than in real life, like bear size. These animals were dying due to the lack of water. It was as though the planet couldn't support these wildlife species. I was touched and felt their anguish and did not want to be part of this audience watching them. Sitting behind my husband and myself were some older men laughing at what was on the screen. I left not wanting to watch. Then I came upon a workout area for stretching and so on, and an area with blue wavy air-like material on the floor that moves up and down like breath or waves. I wanted to lie on it. It was aid to rejuvenate you. I was told by one of the employees that I was too full of water, which is good, but that to benefit from this kind of session, one had to be parched to get the most out of it. It was as though I was too full to need it. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of inflation that this recipe is talking about. Someone who's just too full of himself to listen to anything else. So that the unconscious is more like a set of plastic waves than a living reality. So the parching would be the drying to try to eventually show the person that they're really not quite as great as they think they are. But not much happened because the water was just plastic. Yeah. Well, there's a king and a queen. And I would say typically the king represents the masculine values and the queen represents the feminine values. And a king always has a queen with it. We're talking about the king so much because that's the image that shows up in alchemy. But traditionally, for a woman, it would be just the opposite. It wouldn't be the queen. It wouldn't be the king, it would be the queen who goes through a period of death and rebirth. But we are no longer fitting traditional models. So this little girl dreamt not of a queen, but of a king. I think it's talking about her professional future, which would be the traditionally masculine. But in a pure sense, the woman, what we've talked about for the king, would be for a woman the queen.
And women will be dreaming of queens.
Typically, women would be dreaming of queens. Now, we're both dreaming of kings and queens. So a man would dream of a queen when it's a question of his values in the area of relationship, and a king when it's his values in terms of outer societal involvement. Well, a teacher is a woman. A political leader is a woman. A nun. I mean, there are, one of the problems is there's far fewer images for women than there are for men of the feminine.
When you talk about the
Black Madonna. Black Madonna? Definitely. Definitely. I think one of the problems for women is to see that Mary would be a queen. That was a dominant image for women and a prescriber of a certain lifestyle for 2,000 years. The Black Madonna would be another image of woman, another queen to replace the Mary Light Queen. Native Americans provide images of that? Yeah. Any guiding female figure, a grandma, very often. Grand, because grand means great, so it's not grandma, it's the great feminine.
Air
conditioner on
in there?
Is it too cold?
I think so.
Yeah.
What's the temperature? Pardon me, Gary, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
It's cold up here. Yeah, it's cold.
It's cold down here.
Why
just felt it come on?
I thought it was a year.
No, it wasn't. Thank you.
Let's do one more recipe and then we'll take a break. Or I don't know if we'll get through part of it and we'll take a break. This is another recipe, and you'll see the great difference between this and the other. And again, this is one of probably 20 Jung talks about in that King and Queen chapter. There was a certain Baron King by birth. See right away, Baron, that value system is not creating any fertility in life. Composed of the purest, noblest earth. By nature, nature is sanguine and devout, yet he sadly bewailed his authority. So the king here is shown as old, impotent, and sad, the value system is not working. Whereupon am I king and head of all? So just compare that with the beginning of the last recipe. Whereupon am I king and head of all those men and things that be corporal? I have no issue, yet I'll not deny. 'Tis me both heaven and earth are ruled by. So no issue would mean no children. That value system is not able to continue generating new understandings that life might require. Nothing new can come out of it. So the king's normal ruling capacity is here shown as very lame. Maybe I should just throw in here something which you may have realized, but let me just say it. We're living in a time of the collective transformation of the king. The ruling values used to be the church, and they're not working. I would say any value that you can think of that would have been important 100 years ago is not important today. Politeness, honesty, truthfulness. All of this is what is behind our social chaos. The values are collapsing. Now, Jung, of course, would see that as they're collapsing for a new resuscitation of a more workable value system. The value system of the church, for example, talked about goodness but didn't mind priests molesting children. That's an example of a value system that is in need of resuscitation, and when it would show up in a dream, it would show up as a weak king. We may not feel it's weak, but it would show up in the dream as weak.
It wasn't authentic, the value system, wasn't it?
Right.
The politeness kind of
strategy. Yes. Which you can say now, we can see now, but maybe 1,000 years ago when people were killing each other because they didn't say hello the right way, it was important. But we have changed.
Like in Pauli's dream, there was the blonde man, but he couldn't get to the Persian. The idea was there, but it wasn't operating on the physical level. They
right.
were speaking of one value.
And living another.
Yeah.
Right. Alas, my nature is restricted so, no tincture from my body yet can flow. It therefore is inficont, neither can it aught avail in generating man. Here's an alchemical picture of that tincture, often thought to be flowing from the heart of Christ, and that would be the blood from Christ, here used to illustrate the concept of the tincture. The tincture would be that effect of the values in helping life flow meaningfully. The blood is shooting out and they're trying to capture it in their helmets.
To interject the value system from the clean
path? No, that would be a picture of a value system that's working, and what it offers is a sense that the flow of life is precious. That would be why it's a sacred image.
And
that sustains. Yes, good. It sustains. And it nourishes, and it gives you the feeling that you are moving forward meaningfully. But you see, his tincture is not flowing. So this is a story of values that have ceased giving life a feeling that what the way we live sustains us emotionally. Pardon me? Well, fire would be present in all these images, because this all takes place in the alchemist's mind through cooking. And as a metaphor, it would be the emotions and the heat they add. I mentioned there are a couple of parallels. Jung mentions the way this will show up in dreams is water flowing And the biblical parallels would be the water flowing from Christ's side and it's being wounded. So there, that is still, even though that Christ image is wounded, it is still shown at that time as capable of sustaining. Now it doesn't sustain. I just thought about, you know, the word we hear so much now, sustainability. Our value system is not based on how can we sustain the earth. I think we could think of it in the same exact same sense. That our value system is not giving us the tincture to sustain life. My mother in a sphere gave birth to me, that I might contemplate rotundity and be more pure of kind than other things by right of dignity, the peer of kings. Yet to my grief, I know unless I feed on the specifics I so sorely need, I cannot generate. To my amaze, the end draws near for me, Ancient of Days. A couple of the themes that would draw your attention to. One is the rotundity would refer to this image being representative of wholeness, of the most complete way we are able to understand what our life needs to make it meaningful. That's the circle business. The other image is that the king himself needs to feed. He has specific needs, meaning that the here is where the ego must put energy into this process for it to succeed. Once the process of the transformation of a value system starts, we have to give it regular attention through dream work. The Ancient of Days is something Jung makes a great deal of because it's the way Yahweh is described in the Old Testament. So ultimately what we are working on in the King is the understanding of what God is in a given time period. The transformation, the God image, is the deepest layer of this alchemical journey. Because those values are, and the king, are ultimately based on how we understand what God is. And therefore, that I may be born again, I'd humbled into my mother's breast, dissolved to my first matter, and there to rest. So that is an image of disorientation. The values are dissolved and go back to the unconscious, meaning that the conscious personality no longer knows what's important and trusts into this inner development from the unconscious to begin reforming another value system. But the way that is experienced is despair and disorientation. It's not quite the same as depression. Despair is wanting something but not being able to get it. Depression is not having the capacity to want it. But at this point in the work, you know something needs to be created, and all you are able to experience is nothingness. And the art of this work, a lot of it involves enduring that dark night of the soul. But not seeing the way to get it. Seeing no possibility of getting it.
Or not even wanting
would be depression.
That's depression. Okay.
Not wanting.
Not wanting would be depression.
And the other one is?
Wanting but seeing no way to get it.
Would be what?
Despair.
Despair, okay.
They often feel the same. But I think it's important to distinguish. Yeah.
Not wanting what? The change?
Anything.
Okay.
Very depressed people.
My old wife.
Just look at life and go, yuck. I don't see anything here that's satisfying. And I don't want it. That's why they kill themselves. I don't want this. Where in this process, you know there's something. You just haven't got... You can't stomach the old anymore. You know there's something new to come, but you're not there, and you have to live in confusion and the heartache through the absence of satisfaction, because the new values aren't there yet. But you do know there's something worth fighting for. Yes, that's a good way to put it. Yeah, I think you're right.
Well, then how does the person say a person is happening to a person? And so if they're in depression, then they might not be able to get out of it because they can't activate. Well, how would you do? If a person comes to you in depression, how do you get them connected to enough new things that they can begin having an opening? Or are they forever trapped?
No, but what I was trying to say is the what transpires is different. Where the individual is depressed, you're looking in the dreams for what might give them joy. And when they find it, they can get it. It's there, but they are not able to mobilize the resources to get it. Or in despair, they are able to mobilize the resources to get it, but it's not there. The possibility is not there.
And then how do you deal with that? In other words, when say a person comes to you in despair, what do you look for?
Well, then that's where we go to this. You would say, oh, you are dissolved. And, you know, this, I have some images later of the death of the king. We'll talk about that later. But really what you will see in dreams at this point is dismemberment imagery. I just saw one last week that the dreamer saw the body of a child that had been torn apart, and all that was left was a torso. And where you would normally feel disgusted at such a thing, you know, it was not disgusting in the dream. It was, we have to preserve this torso, end of dream. But I could say that torso is what is left of you, now that everything else is falling apart. Hang on until we can put arms and legs, until the unconscious shows us the way to put arms and legs on that torso. And then you'll be getting a new value system. In this case, it was somebody who was highly functional, but bored to death with their work. And in a sense, saying, my God, I spent 12 years in college and graduate schools getting a PhD, and now I'm bored. But the torso said, yes, you should be bored, because your values are going through a change. You're going to come out with a new understanding of your profession, and now hold on through this period, because your king has dissolved back into the mother. To the unconscious. See how this stuff is so helpful. That dismemberment image would normally disgust somebody. Another frequent image here is, you know, things just getting torn apart, where common sense would be disgusted and askew it. When we know this imagery, we can say, no, that is a very valuable part of this process. Hang on. What is happening isn't wrong. It's right. It's just the darkness that precedes the dawn. And that we get when we know these recipes. That's why Jung worked with this stuff.
Is it
dark journey?
Well, here, the dark journey is just starting. That's the first step. Here, the dark journey, and see, it's not nearly as graphic. The guy's dead, they put him back together, he goes on. But in a deeper change, you can feel this value system, meaning the person to whom that value system is oriented, is suffering. They are dissolved.
Mm-hmm. In this instance, it became very kind of self-aware.
Yes.
Is that necessary for...
No. I mean, again, I gave you a low-level and a high-level recipe, so to speak, for a change that is merely putting somebody back on their feet without much awareness versus a change that is fundamental, where everything changes. And I've seen people, new career, new friends, new spouse, everything is redone. Because the old values simply weren't giving them what they knew life should hold.
In the first one, it seems like outer forces are constantly working on them, and so you can almost see the inflation there they're doing to me.
Mm-hmm.
This one is more interdirected to me and very much more emotionally connected to the process, where if you can tell it's happening inside the person from the language and really just feeling of it.
Yeah.
There's some suffering going on here. Well, there's a capacity for reflection. In the first one, there was no
capacity for suffering, capacity for reflection. See, in the dream, there's no capacity for reflection. Person was too full of himself. Everything was somebody else's fault. And until life smashes you, or inwardly you get smashed, not much you can do. Only when somebody says help, you can help them, as I'm sure some of you know.